It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
They had spoken several times by phone, but it was the first time they had sat down face to face. Both leaders feeling optimistic about the road ahead.
President Putin and I have been discussing various things, and I think it's going very well. We've had some very, very good talks.
I am delighted to be able to meet you personally, Mr. President, and I hope, as you have said, our meeting will yield positive results.
By G20 standards, the bilateral meeting was epic. A full 2 hours and 15 minutes as Presidents Trump and Putin chewed over some difficult issues, including charges that Russia was meddling in the U.S. election.
The President opened the meeting with President Putin by raising the concerns of the American people regarding Russian interference in the 2016 election. The president pressed President Putin on more than one occasion regarding Russian involvement.
The fact that President Trump confronted Putin over election interference may quiet some of the chorus of criticism that was renewed after the president just yesterday appeared to soft-pedal Russian culpability.
Well, I think it was Russia, and I think it could have been other people in other countries.
Putin denied any involvement in election interference. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said after the meeting that President Trump had accepted that assurance. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson appeared to contradict that claim, but did say the president believes rebuilding the U.S.-Russia relationship is the bigger issue.
The president's rightly focused on how do we move forward from what may be simply an intractable disagreement at this point.
The two leaders did manage agreement on one aspect of a divisive issue, Syria. Together with Jordan, the U.S. and Russia will establish a ceasefire and de-escalation zone in southwest Syria. The pact, which goes into effect on Sunday, is designed to cool off tensions while the battle against ISIS continues and a political solution to Syria is put in place.
All right, that was John Roberts on Fox. That was Friday, actually, the special report on Friday. Sandy Rios with you on this Monday morning. Of course, all the media wants to talk about, including John, is the meeting of President Trump with Vladimir Putin. And we're going to come back to that in just a second. But there were other things. You know, I know it's amazing, but actually other things happened. There were other things to talk about. And so I want to mention just a few of those. Bloomberg has a report on what happened to the G20 and the outcomes, and just two things were notable to me. I'm sure I'm kind of, I see things through my grid too, no question about it. But let me just say that the groups in Hamburg agreed to fight protectionism while tacitly recognizing Trump's concerns about excess steel capacity and what he says are unfair trade practices. On climate change, the U.S. was again isolated, with all other 19 members agreeing that the Paris Accord on cutting harmful emissions was irreversible. So two things. The president insisted that unfair trade practices by the European Union toward the United States must stop, not just the European Union, but the 19 of the G20. And they heard him and received it. And he said also he was not joining Paris, not going to do it. Those are the two things that I think are really important coming out of that accord. And then just as a sidebar, kind of a metaphor, sort of a symbol of President Trump and the difference that he's making. There's a picture of the G20 lined up. You know, there are many pictures of the G20 lined up. They all have the G20 summit pin on their lapel, but not President Trump. He has an American flag on his lapel. What a refreshing change. A little different, don't you think? Also, just on a personal sidebar, you probably saw the video. If you didn't, it's actually kind of, it's fun. It's President Trump approaching Marine One. That's the helicopter that flies him around. And the wind is blowing. Of course, it always does when a helicopter's, you know, propellers are going. And the Marine who was standing by the stairs that he was going to go up, his hat blew off. And President Trump jumped down and picked up his hat, put it on the Marine's head, patted him on the shoulder. Because the Marine can't move. Protocol requires him to stand very, very still. And the hat blows off again, and President Trump goes chasing it again. And then hands it off to one of the commanders with him, and the commander fixed the hat. But just a little sidebar, just interesting stuff. Another interesting thing happened. This was funny. Macron, you know, the new president of France, the very young president, whose wife is, what, almost 30 years older than he is, I think. Remember that election. We talked quite a bit about it. You know, he's very officially does not like Trump, you know, cannot stand, you know, this... whatever we are, we're sort of nationalistic. The view of Trump that he's nationalistic and too enclosed. Well, there's a picture of Macron during a time when they're getting ready to take this picture of the G20 leaders standing, you know, on the risers, you know, as you can see in your mind because you've seen it. You see Macron, you know, pushing his way, like coming down two risers, you know, doing everything he can to come down then and stand on the end of the picture next to President Trump. It's really very funny. It's really, really very funny. So, you know, you could say what you will, but that's kind of the insight on human nature, both Trump's and Macron's as well. But Pope Francis is weighing in. Of course, he likes to weigh in, and this is what he's saying. He told an Italian newspaper that the United States, Russia, China, North Korea, and Syria, Bashar al-Assad, Syria, have a, quote, distorted vision of the world. And so you say, why? And the paper asks him why, and he says, the danger concerns immigration. Our main and unfortunately growing problem in the world today is that of the poor, the weak, the excluded, which includes migrants. That's why the G20 worries me. It mainly hits immigrants. So, you know, don't misunderstand. I know some are willingly misunderstanding that, of course, we always should be concerned about the poor, people that need help. But this is always a distortion by the Pope. Pope is a socialist. There's no question about it. And he wants to help the world. But I don't see him emptying the Vatican's treasuries to do that. Have you seen that? Have you seen him selling the treasures buried deep in the Vatican's vaults, all the millions of dollars that they have that they get from poor constituents all around the world, you know, South America, where people are poor, poor Mexican immigrants here who are encouraged to give their money to the Catholic Church while the Catholic Church continues to live in wealth. The Pope lives in the middle of wealth. I don't see him giving that away. I don't see him tearing down the Vatican wall. And so, you know, this is the point. The point is you have to apply common sense to policy. The Pope is, to me, a blind socialist, and among other things. And so he's saying that they have a frightening view of the world. The United States, and so it goes. Just a couple of other things about President Trump that I wanted to tell you. There's a last Friday there was a jobs report. Actually, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I think it was 220,000 new jobs in the month of June, which was I think something like 50,000, maybe 40 to 50,000 more than they had anticipated. And so it was a really, really good report. So that's happening. Also, another headline caught my mind. Hundreds of VA officials fired since Trump's inauguration. Now, do I have to explain what a nightmare the VA has become in VA hospitals? Just horrible, the things they've done to our veterans. And so now there have been 747 disciplinary actions, including 526 employees fired since January 20th. And they range from a tractor operator to VA attorneys. So all of that has happened while we've been talking about Russia. And of course, we have to talk about Russia because we're forced to do that. Happy to do it, actually. Now, the New York Times, in the midst of the G20, published a story. I think it came out on Saturday. Trump team met with lawyer linked to Kremlin during campaign. And it's a long story. It's like, what? I lost it. It's eight pages long in the New York Times. And it lays that, you know, they met, you know, Donald Trump Jr. met with this Russian attorney, and it was just a few days after Donald Trump won the nomination. So the inference, of course, is that just because they met with a Russian attorney, that means collusion. And could I just say, if I have to say it again, I will say it again. We have had relationships with the Russians since the Soviet Union broke up, and even before that. I know a ton of Russians. I must be colluding with them. I mean, it's just a ridiculous thing to think that any Russian that talked to any person in any campaign automatically means collusion. That's just silly, I have to say. And now we know more about this attorney. It looks as though she misrepresented herself. I could see the clock here. I don't have time to go through all of this. Let me just say that she is, it looks as though at this point she is connected to Fusion GPS. Now, why, if that's familiar to you, might be because I actually have talked about this quite a bit. If the name Fusion GPS doesn't mean anything to you, if I say the fake Russian dossier on President Trump, you might remember that. Because Fusion GPS, with this former British agent, are the ones that prepared that opposition piece on President Trump that turned out to be completely false. It was the one the FBI actually used, actually paid Christopher Steele, the former British agent, actually paid him money to complete this dossier. It was originally, as we understand, we don't know what the names are, but some Democratic operative started all of this, paying GPS to gather opposition research on President Trump. And now it looks as though, now this is not conclusive, but it looks as though that this female Russian attorney was connected to GPS and that this may have been, in fact, a setup when the Trump son got in there. He said he didn't, they misrepresented themselves. The meeting was very short. He thought they were talking about Russian adoption. And in part, there was some mention of that. And without me going into the right, there's a law that we passed that said that we would not have dealings with Russians who had bad human rights violations. Vladimir Putin hated that law, and as a result, he stopped adoptions by Americans of Russian children. And so this woman wants that law reinstated. She represents Vladimir Putin, but what connection beyond that? I'm sure you'll hear more about this. This will be big in the news today. But it looks as though it's that Fusion GPS originally hired by Democrats and paid in part by the FBI also. Of course, Comey, you know, he has nothing to do with the Democrats, right? And neither does McCabe, who's the one in charge, whose wife got $700,000 from Terry McAuliffe to run for the Democratic Party in Virginia. I'm sure there's no connection between the FBI and the Democratic Party. And speaking, I'm sure there is. Unfortunately, I'm sure there is. And speaking of Comey, there's more information coming out about his part and those private memos. And I'm going to jump ahead here. I want us to go to clip number 10 because I want you to get this as a backdrop and then I'll explain. Let's listen.
You said after you were dismissed, you gave information to a friend so that friend could get that information into the public media.
Correct.
What kind of information was that? What kind of information did you give to a friend?
That the Flynn conversation, that the president had asked me to let the Flynn, I mean, I'm forgetting my exact own words, but the conversation in the Oval Office.
So you didn't consider your memo or your sense of that conversation to be a government document. You considered to be somehow your own personal document that you could share with the media as you wanted to?
Correct.
Through a friend?
I understood this to be my recollection recorded of my conversation with the president. As a private citizen, I felt free to share that. I thought it very important to get it out.
So were all of your memos that you recorded on classified or other documents memos that might be yours as a private citizen?
I'm sorry, I'm not following the question.
Well, I think you said you'd use classified.
Oh, yeah, not the classified documents. Unclassified. I don't have any of them anymore, but I gave them to the special counsel. But, yeah, my view was that the content of those unclassified, the memorialization of those conversations was my recollection recorded.
All right, that was Senator Roy Blunt grilling former FBI Director Comey in those Senate investigations. And now we learn that the FBI memos, the memos that Comey wrote, contained classified information. Absolutely contain classified information. FBI agents.
So What would you do with an extra $500 a month in your budget? $500. This isn't hypothetical, by the way. This is something you may need to think about very soon if you decide to become a member of MediShare. MediShare is a way to pay for your health care, and typically it costs $500 less per month for a family versus other health care plans. So seriously, think about this. You could pay off loans, pay down a mortgage, save the money for retirement, donate to charity. That would be a big deal. But you know what? Here's the best thing. MediShare works. It has 250,000 members, and it's growing fast. With MediShare, not only do you save, you don't have to pay for things you don't believe in either, and that is a beautiful thing too. So here's how you can find out more, and you might actually wind up saving even more than $500 a month. So check into it. Here's the number. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23, now available in Montana. 855-PSALM-23.
We're witnessing a generation of teens who've become addicted to their personal rights. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. More and more kids today believe they're entitled to anything and everything. They want more, demand more, and expect more than any other generation. So how do you keep your teen from thinking he rules the world? First, you need to quit feeding his worldview. Stop doing everything for your teen. Quit jumping every time she says frog. And instead, tell her it's time to start doing things for herself. Let him wash his own laundry for a change. Your teen may roll his eyes, but if you stick to your guns, your child will slowly understand the universe does not spin under their control.
Mark Gregston has prepared a brand new resource to help parents make the most of their teens' extra time during summer vacation. Download your free copy online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with this Fox News and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Blake Bramlett. I graduated in May of 2016, and I graduated with a degree in interdisciplinary studies, focusing in psychology and missions. The professors here at TMU have really impacted my life in more than one way. In the classroom, of course, but really honestly, what makes the experience at Truett better is that they're mentors to us.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
There's a bit of controversy brewing in Memphis, Tennessee, my hometown, where Elvis is still king and the pork butt is smoked low and slow. Turns out there's a vegan cafe in Memphis, and it's getting some bad reviews from diners. According to one patron, they said the owner's toddler was allowed to run around the dining room buck naked. But it gets worse. The child apparently stood on a table with dirty feet and mooned customers. Now, if that doesn't curdle your tofu burger, I don't know what will. The owners of the cafe are furious, threatening to expose the anonymous complainers. They say they have no problem with the kid running around without any clothes on, and said haters should eat their bean sprouts somewhere else. The jaw dropper, though, is not a kid running around buck naked in the diner. The jaw dropper is there's a vegan restaurant in Memphis. It's barbecue country. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
From coast to coast and in states red and blue, there's been strong resistance to the White House's attempts to obtain details about American voters. In an effort, the White House says, to shore up the nation's election systems and to fight voter fraud. The White House Voter Integrity Commission seeking publicly available information when and only when recorded by and available from state voter rolls, including first and last names of all registrants, addresses, dates of birth, political party, last four digits of Social Security numbers, and more. While the headlines make state opposition seem almost unanimous, as is often the case, the headlines can be a bit misleading, because while several states are refusing to cooperate, many others have agreed to release some voter information. For instance, Fox News reporting shows 25 states so far have declined to take part, while the White House says the number's actually 14 plus the District of Columbia. And while we found 18 states have agreed to comply, at least in part, the White House says the number's actually 20, and reports to the contrary, they say, are fake news. The president took to Twitter to question why there was so much resistance. Numerous states are refusing to give information to the very distinguished voter fraud panel. What are they trying to hide? That drew a sharp retort from Maryland's Democratic Attorney General, who called the request for voter data, quote, repugnant, and that it appears designed only to intimidate voters and to indulge President Trump's fantasy that he won the popular vote.
Giving the federal government one trove of all of this information about all of these voters in one place does present privacy concerns, not just that the government can't maintain information security, as we know hacking is a thing, but also that in the wrong hands, it would be too easily misused.
Backers say abuse of the voting system is the primary concern behind the commission, noting a 2012 Pew Research study that found almost 2 million dead voters still on voter rolls and almost 3 million people registered in multiple states, though that study did not find any evidence of actual voter fraud. The commission's very first meeting, Brett, is actually set for July 19th. That is, by the way, the very same day that the DNC has scheduled a meeting of its Voting Rights Commission.
All right, that was Kevin Corrick on Fox last week, and it's an important story that we haven't covered yet, and it's ongoing. And that is the formation of this Presidential Commission on Election Integrity. The chairman of the committee is Mike Pence, the vice president. A co-chair is Kris Kobach, who is very well known for fighting voter fraud, and he's a firebrand for the left, and he is the co-chair of this. But also sitting on this committee is Hans von Spakovsky, who is a good friend, works for Heritage. He's the senior legal fellow there. He's an expert of all things election. And I asked him to join us this morning because he is very much a part of what's happening in this front. Thanks, Hans, for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, so I think, you know, Kevin actually gave a pretty good synopsis of what we know about voter fraud, but what more do we know, Hans? I mean, you know, when this stuff was reported during the election cycle, remember Obama poo-pooed it, so did Hillary. There's never been any election fraud. How dare they suggest that people are voting that shouldn't be voting? That's kind of the outrage we heard.
Yeah, and they want to continue that myth, which is why they apparently are resisting cooperating with this commission. Look, we have a database at the Heritage Foundation. We only started not too long ago. We're not even doing extensive research, but we started a database of voter fraud convictions from around the country. So these are cases where somebody's actually convicted in court of law. We're up to almost 600 cases, almost 900 individuals convicted, and that's without doing a whole lot of work or research. So that kind of gives you an idea of what's out there. What I found particularly bizarre were the reactions of people like the Maryland Attorney General saying, well, we're not going to provide this information. This is all private. Well, that is just a complete and total lie. Every state in the country, including Maryland, provides the exact same information the commission asked for to political parties, to candidates, and to commercial data companies. Where do people think candidates, for example, get the lists of voters who they contact to ask to vote for them? They buy it from all of the states. So it's just kind of bizarre, the reaction to this.
You know, Byron York did a long piece on that, Hans, about the fact that just tracing what's for sale. He even reprints, you know, things on websites from various states, Virginia included, where they offer this information. And so just to drive home your point, this is commonly done. It's not like you guys are asking for terribly sensitive information that nobody can get. And Terry McAuliffe's response, Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, we should talk about that because Brent Shearer talks about the hypocrisy of Terry McAuliffe. But I'm going to let you speak to it because I think you know all about that.
Yeah, Terry McAuliffe also made the same reaction. Had the same reaction, even though Virginia, just like other states, makes this data commercially available. But let me tell you what's so really odd about it is, in Virginia, the governor is not in charge of elections. There is an independent, supposedly independent state board of elections who's in charge of the election process and voter registration, and they are the ones who should be saying whether or not Virginia will cooperate with this request. And yet the governor comes out and says, oh, we're not doing it, which I think seems to be saying that it really isn't an independent board and that the two people that he appointed to it are just simply his minions and who are going to do what he tells them to do. That's not the way elections are supposed to work in this state.
You know, just to draw, and also I think McAuliffe kind of personifies the kind of spin that's being put on this. He was, first of all, he said he had no intention of honoring this request. McAuliffe stated in his rejection that there was no evidence of voter fraud in Virginia and that the only irregularity in the 2016 presidential election centered around Russian tampering. And he says that the commission, your commission, is set up as a tool to commit large-scale voter suppression. Well, there's a lot of rich territory there, Hans. Take off. Respond
well,
to that.
Well, it's kind of funny him saying there's no voter fraud to say, because we certainly have a number of cases, more than a dozen, I think, from Virginia in our database. And just 2 weeks ago, people can Google this, just 2 weeks ago, a student, college student, was sentenced to jail time for submitting fraudulent voter registration forms, names that he had basically kind of made up to get registered to vote. So the idea that we don't have fraud here is just crazy. In fact, about a year ago, as part of this nationwide program that Kansas runs, Virginia was told that it had almost 300,000 voters registered in Virginia who are also registered in other states. And when the state legislature of Virginia, which is controlled by Republicans, passed a bill that would have provided the resources to actually check the voter histories of those individuals to see whether they were voting in more than one state, Terry McAuliffe did? He vetoed the bill.
And that's not the only bill on voter registration. I'm trying to clean up the voter rolls and do something
right
to make sure only citizens are voting. He has a record of doing that. And then it has to be also said, I don't want to spend all my time on Virginia, but isn't Terry McAuliffe the governor that pushed through this legislation or is issued an executive order to allow felons to vote in prison?
Yes, he is. He basically twisted the Constitution of the state of Virginia, which says that, the governor can pardon people and restore their right to vote on a case-by-case, individual basis. And he just issued a blanket order restoring the voting rights of all of the felons in the state.
Yeah. So, and in the process of that, that was very sloppy, and a lot of people voted that should not have been voting, even by his own rules. So, you know, that he's just such a, yeah, you can't trust what he says or does, and that's the point. But you know what? I found it pretty amazing that there are Republican secretaries of state who are expressing their outrage. I was looking, Mississippi's Republican Secretary of State, Delbert Hosemann, says, my reply would be they can go jump in the Gulf of Mexico. And then you've got South Carolina's Republican Governor Henry McMaster. Constitution ensures voters' ballot choices will always be secret. Americans have died protecting this freedom. So you've got opposition from Republican secretaries of state, too.
Well, I don't really understand what they're talking about. We have a secret ballot in this country. It's been secret for more than 100 years. And getting this voter registration data isn't some kind of invasion of privacy. If that's true, I didn't hear a declaration from them that they're going to stop selling this data to the private data companies that are out there, companies like Catalyst and Aristotle, which take all of this voter registration data and repackage it and then sell it to candidates and political parties. What, are they going to stop selling the data to them too?
Hans, let's talk about, well, you know the answer is no. Sorry, I didn't answer that, but let's talk about what it is that you are actually trying to do with this voter commission. What are you trying to do?
Look, we're trying to find out how good or how bad is the current system that we have. And what I mean by that, for example, is that, look, we basically have an honor system in this country when it comes to elections. There's no verification or check made, for example, when people register to vote of all the information coming in. Is it their real name? Do they really live at the address they're claiming? Are they really a U.S. citizen the way they claim? That's not done. And so we need to find out, well, you know, look, most people are honest, but how many people who are being dishonest are, in fact, registering to vote where they don't really live, are registering to vote because they're not even though they're not U.S. citizens. We need to find out the extent of the possible problem of illegal voting and also whether states are doing what it takes to clean up their voter rolls and get rid of people like the 2 million who have died, who are still on the rolls. Are they taking care of those problems? What do we need to do to ensure that we have a secure system, one in which everybody who's eligible gets to vote and their votes aren't stolen or diluted by people who shouldn't be voting, like the cases I have sitting on my desk of non-citizens who were found who have illegally registered and voted?
Now, if they don't cooperate with you, and I guess we've probably overstated, I guess there's more cooperation than's being reported. Is that fair to say?
I believe that is fair to say, yes.
Yeah, and so, but if you don't get full cooperation, can you, since this stuff is public now, are you guys going to have to go through and buy all these records?
Yeah, I don't know what the commission's going to do about that, but yeah, there are commercially available copies of these lists. It would be nice, I think, better to get them actually from the states, but, you know, that might be an alternative we might have to go through.
You know, Hansa, I'm curious, there are so many Republican-led legislatures in the country, most of them are, I think two-thirds or more, and so could there be some sort of legislative forcing of Secretary of State to cooperate with this effort?
Yeah, there certainly could be, but I'm hopeful that what will happen is that some of these Secretaries of State will realize that perhaps they overreacted and are looking at this the wrong way, and that they will decide that they really should help this commission, which is a bipartisan commission, help it investigate and research the problem of election integrity in the country.
One thing that I know is going to be a bit of a problem, I think that, I know we've talked, our mutual friend Christian Adams talks a lot about this, he has used, excuse me, some sort of a measurement of whether people are some form where they have to declare whether they voted illegally or not before they can become citizens. And there was an assumption that Homeland Security was keeping records on people who are here legally and illegally and who have voted and who haven't. And that it seems as though Rowan Scarborough is reporting that those records actually don't exist. That's a huge problem, isn't it?
It is a huge problem, and that's one of the other things that, in fact, this commission needs to investigate. Are there files over at the Department of Homeland Security on investigations where ICE agents discovered that somebody who's not a U.S. citizen actually registered and or voted? I read that story myself. I don't know whether it's true, but it's something that the commission has a duty to find out.
This must be, okay, on a personal level, Hans, you have been so vested in American elections and making them what they should be. This must potentially will be, you know, you've got Chris Kobach and the vice president, I think both of them probably equally committed to voter integrity. And then we have you, and I don't even know who else. Oh, Ken Blackwell is on this committee too, right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, so how are you, I don't know how they're going to stop you guys, honestly.
Well, I got to tell you, the work of this commission is very important. I hope people will cooperate and help it. And I have to, frankly, kind of echo something I think the president did, maybe in a tweet or something, where I say, look, if there's no problem, the way all these opponents are saying, well, why do they want to hide their data, their information, what they're doing? What are they trying to hide?
It's a very good question. And if this big bluster, I wish I had the tapes. I remember at the time when I heard the president say, President Obama, there's no evidence of voter fraud. Why? How dare they say that? I remember Mrs. Clinton saying, how dare they say there's voter fraud? We have the finest system at blah, blah, blah. And I thought at the time, boy, that doesn't sound very believable. It just defies logic. Nevertheless, I'm proud that you're there, Hans. I know you'll do a great job. It's the Presidential Commission on Election Integrity, and we know that you guys will roll up your sleeves and overcome these obstacles. And I look forward to hearing more about this. Hans, thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. When we come back, there's so much news, so just please stay tuned. Fasten your seatbelts. I'll be right back.
rise and go toward the south, to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is a desert place. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Corner. Best-selling author Francis Chan explained why he left the helm of his thriving California megachurch. Chan lamented what he saw as a lack of authentic love display, where parishioners gathered on Sundays, said hi to one another for 30 seconds, and left, only to repeat the same process a week later. He now leads a house church movement in San Francisco. In these difficult times, instead of doing church, we must be the church. Worship isn't an activity. It's a lifestyle.
Visit the Hamilton Corner on the podcast page at AFR.net. For more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association. The American Family Association invites you to help us make In God We Trust more than a slogan. Since 1977, the American Family Association has been a voice to remind America that the blessings of our nation have come from God's gracious hand. Request your free In God We Trust wristband today and order more to give away at afa.net/trustgod. That's afa.net/trustgod. Get 40 and help the American Family Association celebrate our 40th anniversary.
Hello, friend. I'm Pastor Ron Jones, and I'm glad to tell you something good has come to American Family Radio. Something Good is a daily half-hour Bible teaching program that I'm hosting at 6:30 p.m. Central Time. In a world full of so much bad news, we're glad to bring you something good. Learn more at somethinggoodradio.org. That's somethinggoodradio.org.
Dan Celia of Financial Issues.
You know, there's probably never been a more important time in our economy to be thinking about a charitable gift annuity. I hope you'll do that just to shore up, to firm up some more income, permanent income, income that you can count on for the rest of your life while you're doing the Lord's work. A charitable gift annuity has been something I've been talking about for 25 years. Finally, we're seeing even mainstream start to get on board with the merits of charitable gift annuities. I hope you'll consider it. You can call the AFA Foundation. Someone there will help you work through the details and find out whether you qualify for a charitable gift annuity.
Call and speak with a representative of the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Over the weekend, 140,000 people in Los Angeles spent 12 steamy hours without power when a local high-voltage transformer blew up. No one knows the cause of this particular disruption of service, but it's the latest reminder of an ominous reality. The U.S. electric bulk power distribution system, better known as the grid, is literally indispensable to life in 21st century America. If it is widely disrupted and stays down, we'll quickly lose access to clean water, safe food, our finances, transportation, communications, healthcare, etc. The present grid critically depends on several thousand large and vulnerable transformers to move power around the country. There's effectively no way to replace them all. If we lose large numbers of them through enemy action or naturally occurring solar storms, we are toast. To avoid such a fate, we must secure the grid now. This is Frank Affney.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
This was the concern about going home before voting. Senators getting bad headlines in their local newspapers and a rough reception in public. Senator Ted Cruz has faced some protesters back home in Texas this week. And even in typically ruby red Kansas, Senator Jerry Moran has been on the defensive.
Can't be Republican and Democrat stuff. This is so important to get it right. And I will make a decision not based upon my party, but based upon what I think is good for Kansas.
If Moran is getting an earful back in Kansas, that suggests a heavy lift ahead. The idea being allowing insurance companies to sell stripped-down plans, cheaper options. Ted Cruz and fellow conservative Mike Lee are pushing for it, and the Congressional Budget Office is doing an analysis in terms of cost and coverage.
But
Obamacare repeal. That's obviously a big topic right now, one that I'm very, very active in helping lead the effort for Republicans to honor our promise to repeal Obamacare, and then for us to pass patient-centered reforms that drive down the cost of premiums, make health insurance more affordable.
Moderates worry about the impact it would have on people with pre-existing conditions. One analysis compiled by the Roper Center shows this is the least popular major piece of legislation in the past 30 years. The Clinton health care plan of 1994 had on average 48% support. The Bush tax cuts of 2001 had 56.6%. Even TARP, the bank bailout, had 41.3% support. Obamacare had 43.8%. Dodd-Frank bank regulation had 61%. And the American Health Care Act has 28.2% support. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is warning if they cannot pass it, he'll need to work with Democrats to stabilize the insurance markets.
Do you have a crisis?
All right, that was Mike Emanuel. That's a good. That's hot enough. That's Mike Emanuel on Fox. And, of course, you heard those stats. A couple of things. The senators are going home, and they're getting an earful. But remember, see, you can't really, you have to stop and think about what's being said there. When they showed the pictures, like of Jerry Moran in Kansas, and they alluded to Ted Cruz in Texas, those are, for the most part, as far as I know, based on what we're hearing in other districts, those are not Republican voters, conservative voters coming out. Those are people invading those town halls from the other side. So I just don't think that's an accurate assessment. Of course, the senators are such cowards for the most part, with the exception of a few like Cruz, that they can't seem to distinguish themselves. They just see protesters and they freak out. Someone doesn't like me, I might lose my position. Heaven forbid, I might not be a U.S. senator anymore. I have to do whatever the mob is requiring. And even if it's not the mob from my side. So, that's not a good litmus test to me of where the American people stand. And when Mike was going through those stats, I would not trust those stats either. Basically, I'll tell you why. I wanted you to hear them. But remember that those polls were taken during the Obama administration. And I don't know whose polls those were. About TARP and all those other things. I am really suspicious when it comes to numbers. And now we have this number on the American Health Care Act that's being discussed by the U.S. Senate. And it has 28.2% support. Well, you know what? I really don't doubt that. Now, this stat I believe, because this is an unpopular. The Democrats all hate this. So they're not going to vote for it. It's a Republican proposal. And Republicans in the trenches don't want what's being proposed in the Senate right now either. So that's not a shock. And that's why many of us are pushing for a full repeal of Obamacare and something else, a free market solution. Ted Cruz, really, in his own way, and Mike Lee with him, have pushed a solution that I think is excellent. I've told you about it, but we have a clip of Ted Cruz explaining it himself. Let's listen.
We need to focus on the actual facts. How does the Consumer Freedom Amendment operate? It operates as follows. It's designed to be a compromise that can bring together both conservatives and moderates, that can unify the conference. And so what it says is you, the consumer, you, the patient, should have the freedom to choose the insurance you want. It shouldn't be the government dictating what insurance you can buy. So that if an insurance company offers at least one plan that's consistent with the Title I mandate, so that meets all of the mandates that you got to provide right now.
That are part of Obamacare, including pre-existing conditions.
All of that is there. If they offer at least one plan, they can also offer additional plans that consumers may desire. That means you're not taking away anything that is there right now. All of the protection for pre-existing conditions are there, but what you are adding is additional options. So all the people right now who can't afford insurance suddenly will have options of lower premiums where they'll be able to afford coverage that they don't have now.
So in other words, Senator Cruz's solution is, all right, if we can't fully repeal Obamacare, which it sounds like Mitch McConnell doesn't really want to do, that's kind of apparent, isn't it? And the leadership. So Ted is saying, all right, so let Obamacare stay, but then open up the free market and let them offer competing plans. And that if people want to choose Obamacare, they can. Have at it. You can have it if that's what you want. But you can also have whatever the free market comes up with. I think that, honestly, is a great solution. And that reminds me of something just a race. And I've said before to you, I believe, on more than one occasion, that we have to make sure we get senators in the Senate who actually represent the people. And I can think of hardly any of them who should remain right now. Just a handful. The rest of them should go. They should be gone. They are. There's nothing wrong with being old, but in this case, most of them are old and don't care anymore. They just are, if they don't have the energy or they're very comfortable, they've lost their passion, they've lost their way, they need to go. And again, it has nothing to do with age, really, but it just seems that lots of them are old and lots of them have lost their passion. I was thinking about Roy Moore, who's running in Alabama. By the way, there's a report by the AP. He's doing very well in this race so far. And of course, the Mitch McConnells and the Senate Leadership Fund are going to put $350,000 in the race to try to get Luther Strange elected. And then, of course, Mo Brooks, who was at the baseball game where Steve Scalise was shot and others would have been killed if the shooter had had his way. Mo Brooks is also running for that seat. He's a member of the House Freedom Caucus. But, of course, he and, Justice Moore has proven his mettle. He has courage beyond measure. And all I can say is we need men who have courage beyond measure serving in the U.S. Senate. I want to turn my attention to something else. Linda Sarsour, you know the name? Linda Sarsour has become kind of a figure, let's say, in public life, a female jihadist, a female representative of the Muslim Brotherhood. She was one of the organizers of the Women's March in D.C. Last year. In fact, just to give you a taste of what that sounded like, let's listen to clip one.
Respect the presidency, but I will not respect this president of the United States of America.
All right, so then that takes us to just July, just a few days ago, at the 54th Annual Convention of the Islamic Society of North America, which was, by the way, one of the organizations listed in the Holy Land Foundation trial as listed by the Muslim Brotherhood as one of their partners in destroying the United States from within. Just saying. Of course, we somehow have forgotten that. I just don't understand. That is in the FBI files. The FBI under Comey and under Mueller didn't do a thing about this. They stopped the investigation, and that's where it stood. We actually have the plan of the Muslim Brotherhood to infiltrate and undermine our system. And yeah, they're still there. In fact, they're serving. Some of them are Republicans, and you'll find some conservative Republicans defending them. It is just unbelievable, but I digress. So Linda spoke at the 54th Annual Convention of the Islamic Society of North America, and I want you to hear what that sounded like. Let's listen.
I hope that we, when we stand up to those who oppress our communities, that Allah accepts from us that as a form of jihad, that we are struggling against tyrants and rulers, not only abroad in the Middle East or in the other side of the world, but here in these United States of America, where you have fascists and white supremacists and Islamophobes reigning in the White House.
All right, so that was part of what she had to say. So she declared jihad against the Trump administration. Now, you know, the Muslim apologists, the CARE people, the PR arm of the Muslim Brotherhood would tell us that's just a struggle. It's a righteous struggle for good and evil. But jihad actually means a lot more than that. And it's carrying out jihad that the members of the Islamic State and other radical Islamic organizations in the name of jihad behead, because jihad is all about establishing the caliphate and establishing Islam as supreme all over the world, no matter what Linda says. So she basically declared jihad on the Trump administration. And Phil Haney, who of course wrote See Something, Say Nothing, says that Sarsour's choice of words are terrifying on their face. He said they carry additional layers of meaning to Muslims familiar with the Quran and the Hadith. And he said, what we heard from that perspective, her words are even more chilling. The word prepared carries much weight among Muslims waging jihad, whether violent or civilization jihad. It's the same word embedded within the logo of the extremist Muslim Brotherhood. It makes you ask, what are they preparing for? And so then this is what else she said to ISNA. Our number one and top priority is to protect and defend our community. She's talking about Islam. It is not to assimilate and to please any other people in authority. All right, so what does that mean exactly? Well, you know exactly what it means. It's not a play on words. It's very easy to figure out. She's not interested in assimilation in this country, and that's the problem. And Brigitte Gabriel actually did a debate on this that I want you to hear in part. Brigitte, of course, is a head of ACT for America. This is what she had to say about Linda Sarsour. Let's listen.
It is. It's very radical. She was specifically inciting hatred and violence. If these words were coming out of any other person, we would have said, well, you know, that really overstepped the line. But coming from Linda Sarsour, you have to understand her background. This is a lady that comes from a long line of terrorists. Her family members are, as we speak, sitting in Israeli jails for conviction of terrorism. When you look at her praising in her speech at ISNA, Imam Siraj Wahaj, who was a co-conspirator in the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. She called him her hero and her mentor. She called him how he talks to her, how she listens to his voice when she's laying in bed thinking about issues that relate in this country. And then she gives a speech at ISNA, which is the first organization
Bridget, you are hate monger number one in the United States.
You got your turn to speak. It is my turn. Yeah. ISNA is the number one organization listed in the Muslim Brotherhood plan to destroy America. The Muslim Brotherhood is the oldest Islamic terrorist organization in the world. And so when she speaks like that at ISNA, talking about urging Muslims not to assimilate, telling Muslims this is a jihad by basically rebelling against the administration, telling them that do not assimilate, we want to please only Allah and nothing but Allah, that is calls for violence to those who want to commit jihad against America, you know, to the homegrown terrorists, to
something?
The radicals who want to attack, to kill the president, as well as people
Imam,
like you and me, Laura, who are law-abiding citizens.
The FBI and the Secret Service should be monitoring her right now.
All right, so that was Brigitte Gabriel. You know, good for her. God bless Brigitte. I have the honor of serving with her on the SPLC list of Women Against Islam. We're singled out, a dozen of us, for speaking the truth. And so Brigitte is just a champion to me. And, of course, she grew up in Lebanon where she suffered at the hands of the Islamists. She knows about what she's talking about. She was a media personality in the Middle East before she ever came to the United States. She is a great and articulate spokesperson. That reminds me of Michigan, and I'm going to close the show with this because it's a story I actually did not get to cover as fully as I'd like to. But, you know, Michigan right now has a gubernatorial candidate who's associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. I don't have the name in front of me. I wasn't prepared to talk about that, but that's of great concern. And at the same time, in Michigan, there is a nominee. She is a Michigan Supreme Court Justice, Joan Larson. She was nominated by the president to be upgraded to another position on the court, a federal appointee. And so far, the Democratic senators in Michigan, who by Senate rules must ask for the vote for her, have not brought her name up in the committee, and it's been months. And so that's the way they're stonewalling President Trump's nominations. Again, this is Joan Larson. She's a Michigan Supreme Court Justice. She has a great reputation. I don't know much about her other than the fact that others are saying she's done some wonderful things. She has strong support. And yet the Democratic senators in Michigan are preventing her from being voted on. So these are the kinds of games that are being played. And this is a battle, as I've said before, that we have to wage and wage fiercely in this world. While we understand it is a spiritual battle that we also fight. I think both are possible, don't you? I heard a great sermon by David Jeremiah on David over the weekend. Did you hear it? If you haven't, I suggest you listen to it so we can put our battle gear on. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.